from MLU headquarters in Philadelphia.
You should go underneath it.
Oh, way out deep!
This is Cleats and Cuffs.
Hit man! Oh, what a one! Murray!
Everything ultimate, from the field to the boardroom.
Hey, you got this?
There?
Oh, yes!
Hello,
Mr. Graham!
And welcome to Cleats and Cufflinks. I'm back here with Dusty Rose, as usual, on this, we're 2 weeks out of the season, maybe a little bit more.
It's sneaking up, in front of our faces. It's sneaking up.
Yeah, it doesn't even feel like sneaking any before. It's approaching with menace and intent.
It's kind of like when you know you're about to move, and you know that you have all this work right ahead of you to do,
yeah.
But you can't do it yet.
Yeah.
You have to stop and wait, because you're still living here. So we still have this preseason bit that we're working on.
Yep.
And that season is, it's right around the bend.
Man, yeah, we had a little meeting in the office talking about it a bit. You know, most of the people here have been through at least some season.
Yeah.
There's a couple new people, though, and, it's a different animal entirely.
Yeah, the way your time gets used, not only when you're at the office, in the case of lots of the folks here, but if you're me and you're sort of doing it on your own time, the days get a lot shorter all of a sudden.
Yeah.
Watching a lot of tape, studying up on players that I don't recognize from previous years, or study up on players that I didn't know as much about in the past. That's a whole trip now. And it's just like, I remember the momentum that you get sort of once you get that ball rolling. But that initial push to be prepared for the season is now.
It's happening right now. Yeah. And with that in mind, too, of course, season tickets are for sale. People should get out there, get your season tickets, get your player's discount code, you know, show them your support. You can go ahead and ask your favorite player for that via any of your various player contact means, social media, email, accosting them at Winter League.
Just speaking with them pleasantly in person also,
Also an option.
Could you help me with tickets?
Yeah, but they are available. Get out there, check that out. We also, here on the show, have been doing recently our jersey highlights. So if you want to send us a jersey, we'll feature it on the show. We'll talk about your team a little bit. What do we have today in jersey highlights?
Well, we've got two. The first one is the one I'm wearing, which is a Spike jersey from Fool's Fest, which is, again, I think I've mentioned this like every week over the last couple of weeks. It's coming up here in a little bit. This was like a reunion team after Pike turned into Southpaw or was disbanded or whatever. We went to Fool's Fest. As Spike.
I like it.
Which is basically, we tried to get all the people who were into Fun Pike, aka having fun while playing, and sort of focus on that area.
It was never really for that.
Right, we didn't really do that much.
Yeah, it wasn't our thing.
We were all very serious.
Very serious,
yeah. So we tried to like flip the script a little bit.
Yeah. Was there a lot of spiking in the disc on Spike?
Oh, there was a lot of just ridiculousness. There were no pizza slaps, but that's, I mean,
obviously,
you gotta have lines.
You gotta have lines. We all have rules. We also have in the background, and again, I apologize to those of you who listen to this show, but you'll get the idea. In the background, we have another jersey here.
Yeah, that's a jersey from the college team that my brother played for, the Banana Slugs of Santa Cruz. And
one of the few moments where Ultimate is not responsible for the ridiculous name of the team.
Precisely. Yeah. Santa Cruz itself is responsible for that, as well as the beautiful fields that they play and practice on.
Oh, they're beautiful.
And Santa Cruz produces some really excellent Ultimate players. My brother, not quite among them, but still a relevant Ultimate player.
Oh, wow.
But it's sort of an area where you get all sorts of interesting ideas about not just sports, but you know, how to live your life and all these, Santa Cruz is an interesting and beautiful place.
It's a great town. I spend some time there. My wife's aunt is an artist in Santa Cruz, so we get out there now and then. And I, of course, went with Pike when we'd go to that tournament that was out there.
Those fields, you just see off into the
bay. Yeah, yeah.
Mountains in the distance, the mountains of Monterey, I believe. It's great.
It's great. Great disc golf there, too. If you've ever been to De La Viega, it's an amazing disc golf course. For those of you who've retired from Ultimate and have started just playing disc golf.
I'm still working my disc golf game up.
But all right, you'll be ready for it.
It's made my Ultimate throws way better.
See, this is an argument that I hear a lot. and it's good to hear you say that. I appreciate that.
I should have done it so much earlier. I was afraid it was going to make my Ultimate throws bad. I was just wrong.
All right, so get out there and play disc golf. Improve your throws.
Yeah.
We used to use it in college as a way to get rid of people who threw air bounces. Like to get rid of the air bounce in people's throws. Because an air bounce can be very useful in the right hands. In a novice thrower's hands, though, it tends to be disastrous, particularly in Syracuse, New York weather.
But that's the thing. So the best practitioner of the air bounce that I know of is Brett Matsuka, who played originally in Hawaii and Australia and all of this. Those are not calm environments.
True, but, true.
And every single time I see him throw his backhand, I cringe. It fundamentally just, it makes me, I don't know how to throw that throw. I don't know how it goes the way that it goes.
It works.
But it just works. Like, you have to develop your own style.
So, I'm going to jump us out. I'm going to keep going.
Please.
So, we often get criticized on the show.
We do?
About talking about other sports more than we talk about Ultimate. And one thing that I know that you enjoy, probably almost as much as me, is living up to our critics' expectations of us. So before we get too far down the road of talking about Ultimate and throwing mechanics, I want to take a second. A little bit of sad news to lead into this. We want to say a heartfelt goodbye to Johan Cruyff, who is one of the greatest soccer players, football players of all time.
Yes.
I remember Cruyff. So when you grew up playing soccer at my age in the United States,
you had to search.
There weren't a lot of places to watch it.
Yep.
And we were actually a lot like skateboard culture, where we had videos, and
action
you could
tapes.
Order up tapes. That would have, you know, greatest goals, greatest moves, you know, highlights from some of the greatest games, all of this kind of thing kind of built in. And he was such a feature in those videos. So Johan Cruyff, famous for his play with Ajax in the Netherlands and for his play with Barcelona, and also, of course, for his play
First
with the famous
team.
Dutch national team,
yeah.
Clockwork Orange. And, you know, he won the Ballon d'Or, which is the greatest player in the world award, for 3 years.
Which is insane.
What else? He
voted the player of the century in Europe for the last century, not this current century.
Yeah, that was in 1999.
Yes.
So the last completed century, greatest player in Europe.
What a title that is.
That's a title. That's a title. He only played in one World Cup. The Netherlands is an interesting World Cup history anyway. They've appeared in the most finals without winning.
Yep.
They're like the Buffalo Bills of the World Cup.
And to be, this is the Dutch national team is kind of how I got into soccer, and the way that we were taught to think about soccer as kids. It's from my father, who was into the Dutch national team and all of that, sort of the style that you play in.
Well, that's the most interesting part about this, and I think the part that's going to leverage us in here, right? You take this guy, Cruyff, who's an amazing player, nominally a forward, but would play all over the field. Had a move named after him, which I know you probably learned growing up. We learned a lot of moves named after players growing up. We had the Sir Stanley Matthews, which is a little in and out tap thing. We had the Beckenbauer, which is like this push behind your leg.
It's always using your one strong foot to hide your weak foot.
Yep.
Beckenbauer.
Yeah, exactly. And then you had the Cruyff, which I was reading Roger Bennett's kind of obit, if you will, today, and he said that he described it as he turned his upper and lower torso in two directions while flicking the ball in a third. Look it up. You gotta watch it online.
Cruyff turn. Yeah.
The Cruyff
Once you
turn.
See it, you'll recognize it. Players use it very consistently still.
Oh, yeah. And the most amazing example of it is, of course, Cruyff doing it to, I think it was the Swedish defender, who later said that he wasn't embarrassed at all, that was one of his proudest moments. Because he thought he had the ball and Cruyff beat him, but Cruyff's a genius.
So what are you going to do? That's the accepting excellence when you see it, and congratulating excellence is one of the things you learn through sports.
Absolutely. You got to recognize when you're beat and enjoy the opportunity to get taught something. But the end, the thing you were saying is exactly right. There's a style of play here that Cruyff most accurately embodied, which is this idea of total football.
Yeah.
You want to tell the kids what that's about a little bit?
The basic concept there is that while the players have positions that they are nominally tied to and spend the majority of their time being responsible for, some players are better at defense, some players are better at offense, the notion is that you're fluid, and if the game's flow requires that the forwards drop back, then they should drop back, and the rest of the structure of the team should adjust. Same thing if the fullback should pull forward, someone from the front should then drop back. Not necessarily right away, because one of the things that you want to do in this style is you create imbalances. You send more people attacking or more people defending based on what the game itself desires or needs in order for your team to have the strategic advantage. Yeah. So that's like, the basic of it.
Yeah, there's essentially, there's a tactical shape to your team.
Right.
And you can move parts of it, but that shape remains. Yeah. So all the tactical positions get filled, even though the players filling those positions might change. And the thing about it that was always noted is it's highly demanding on the players in right. terms of technical and physical abilities, because you have to be able to be comfortable in pretty much any position on the field. And having a player like Cruyff on the field almost forces this idea of total right. football, because he would drop back into the midfield, he'd go out to the flanks and come in attacking from the sides, and his team had to shift around him and keep the balance, keep the tactics in place.
Because to not do so is to not take advantage of your best player.
Yes.
Because your best player can do all of these things. And it's interesting in the way that he sort of represented this. Like, his ego is legendary as well.
Oh, yeah.
And his idealism about football, a.k.a. soccer, is legendary as well. So this idea that every player should have every skill, he felt that in his bones, because he had every skill, so why don't you?
Yeah, why don't you?
Right, so like, why don't you work as hard? Why aren't you a soccer genius? So yeah. why don't we put 11 soccer geniuses on the field? One of his biggest things was that the goalkeeper was not only the goalkeeper, he was your first defender, he was also your first attacker. So your goalkeeper, in his theory, should have all of these skills as well.
And we've seen how big an effect this has had on soccer to this day, right? Barcelona, you talk to the coaches today, and they'll point to Cruyff, who also coached at Barcelona yep. years ago, as the genesis of what they are now. You look at goalkeepers in the Premier League, they're all incredibly talented passers of the ball and distributors yep. out of the back. It's clearly part of the thing. And we were talking about this earlier and saying, all right, total ultimate. What does that look like, right? Because we have these positions in ultimate,
yep.
you know, largely two.
Generally, that's the standard.
Though certainly there, we could talk, and there are probably more. But you have your handlers and your cutters. But wondering how, you know, this idea of total ultimate, where those are interchangeable positions, in a more dynamic way, and what kind of players like Cruyff would drive teams to be able to make that interchange, where they're capable of throwing that pinpoint throw downfield, but also next minute could be in the end zone on you.
Yeah.
I think Jeff Graham, to some extent, yeah.
I mean, still, the first two people I think of when you mention the idea of a total ultimate player are Jeff Graham and Alan Colick, because I think Jeff Graham, like, his history in the MLU and outside of the MLU just shows that he is and has been and will remain one of the, like, most complete players.
Yeah.
His hucks are on point. His cutting is quick, and it's fast, and its timing is... He's been a very strong player for a long time. If you're looking for a player to model your style after in a classical ultimate style, he's the person you would pick.
And you're going to have to do it from tape, unfortunately. Jeff Graham retiring this year.
It's just
Jeff,
too bad.
It was so great having you here. It is too bad. It's a shame. Not like for us, it's a shame, but it's more a shame for the fans, because what an amazing person to watch. What a great guy with the fans when he'd go out and talk to kids yeah. and stuff like that. So. Just a little aside there, but
and along those same lines is, I mean, if we mention Colick, just to go back to that for half a second,
yeah.
he was underrated as a receiver. A lot of the big plays made for DC over the last 3 years, it wasn't Allen distributing the disc or running the offense. It was a huck goes up to a guy that everybody thought was a handler,
yes.
and then he's skying your deep for it.
Yep.
So it puts that extra pressure on your defense. But if we think about it structurally, as opposed to for specific players, the idea of total football means that at any moment, a fullback can end up attacking and can find the right space. Your sweeper can end up attacking and find the right space. So your defense is compromised by the addition of a player. And the same thing with your offense gets compromised by bringing an extra player back to sort of mess with your offensive backfield.
Mm-hmm.
So in ultimate, what does that mean? Generally, you have defenders who are taught to cover handlers, or defenders who are taught to cover primary cutters or secondary cutters or whatever like that.
Defensive specialists,
right.
in a way.
Yeah. So you're learning what the tendencies of these different positions are and adjusting your play for that. But if you free up the positions a little bit and suddenly you have your handler defender, as soon as you note that, oh, the guy covering me is a handler defender, what your best move will be is often to move downfield and get the defender out of his comfort zone or her comfort zone and put pressure on them that way. It's the same thing, like, if you look at it from the other side, after you force a turnover, one of the best things that you can do is have your tireless D-line cutter be covering the other team's primary offensive handler. Why? Because he's just going to take him on a tour of the field at a high rate of speed after
yes.
the turn. He's going to be like, all right, you're back there throwing these little passes, throwing all these completions. How are you going to do that after 70 or after 10 70-yard sprints.
Yeah.
Because that's what I'm going to do. I don't even have to be part of the offense.
I'm just going to run you around.
It's taking advantage of the matchup that you have. And most club teams and the MLU teams, high-level teams at all level, at the top level, most of the players have the skills to do multiple things. But why don't we ask them to? Is it something off in our structure or in the way that we're looking at the game? So this is where we get to idealism versus realism.
Right, and it ties. It comes into player development too, right? You know, I think often you see raw athletic talent. You're like, I know immediately how to apply that.
Yeah.
I can put that on my D-line and I can get blocks with it. And then I can send that deep and throw to it,
yep.
Right? That's what I'm going to do with that piece of talent. And I think it comes into what we were talking about a couple weeks ago with coaching, being able to look beyond this season, beyond next season, and start to understand, how does this player need to develop over time? And that's the question. Is this sport like football, where it's highly specialized? And I mean American football.
American, right.
Highly specialized, and you're plugging people into very specific roles in a lot of ways. Or is it more like total football, the European version, where a player having the full range of skill set, regardless of the position they play, is the ideal scenario?
Well, so one of the things that comes up is the structure of ultimate when you think about it that way. What is the stall count? So the longer the stall count is, the more encouraged your team can be to play a very slow, resetting the offense every single time that you every single time that you have a new thrower, you can essentially reset your offense, set it up in an ideal way, and then move from there. The shorter you restrict the stall count, the more fluid you have to be. In soccer, the reason you don't hold on to the ball is because someone can take it from you, or you can get turned in the wrong direction and not be able to turn against that defender. In ultimate, the thing that prevents you from just holding on to the frisbee is the stall count. So if you have a high stall count, well, I have 10 seconds to get rid of the disc, so I'm going to wait for the right throw. And if that's your offense, you're not forced to make these like flow of the game decisions. And I think my version of ultimate is very flow-based. It's much more similar to soccer, much more similar to like large-scale field sports, lacrosse, field hockey, things like that, as opposed to American football, where it's like we get a new down and we stop, and then we restart and then we stop. If you think about the stall count as a down,
it's almost an opportunity to reset.
Right. It reveals a little bit more about the way that we've been, the assumptions that we've made about what ultimate is and isn't.
Which, I mean, makes perfect sense to me. When I would catch the disc on the field, that was a sign that the offense needed to reset.
Well, but we were just talking about this a moment ago. It's like, if you catch that in-cut, it's the same thing as a back-to-the-goal striker in soccer.
Right.
So you catch the in-cut, you toss a little pass, and as your defender's still sprinting past you, hoping to get a block,
you're going the other direction.
Way.
Yeah, and you're right. It's a stall count thing. Are we getting now, though? Are we worryingly shifting into your lower stall count territory?
No,
because a lot of people think that the MLU shortened the stall count. But we actually didn't. Like, we based the stall count on the actual stall count. So we watched a bunch of Club Ultimate. We timed it.
Yep.
And we found that a 10 stall count in Club Ultimate is about 7 seconds.
Yep.
And so we got refs and trained them to actually count a real 7 seconds and gave people essentially the same stall count. Because when we tried to run it with a full 10-second stall count, wow.
it's a really long time. And this is something that I mentioned to all my Winter League teammates, my Spring League teammates, all the people that I play with. It's like 10 seconds it's really long. And keep in mind that if somebody touches you or encroaches upon your space, you can get the stall count to be even longer.
Oh, yeah.
So to feel flustered in a Club Ultimate game while you have the disc is a sign of undue anxiety or skills that you haven't learned yet.
Yep. Yep, or a complete offensive breakdown. Let's admit that does happen.
It certainly does. Yeah. So the other thing about stall counts is that I think 7 seconds is still too long.
I'm aware that the work I've
done with a stopwatch says that most passes are released under 3 seconds, and the vast majority of passes are released under 5 seconds. The number of passes that get released after 5 seconds, they're all kind of thrown up in the air anyway.
Yeah.
So if we compress it a little bit further, that's where I would want to see the sport go, but you can compress that time as a team anyway. Your own individual tempo, your team's tempo can be higher or lower depending on how you want it. And I like the fact that you can adjust that.
Mm-hmm,
you're not
mm-hmm.
required to play fast. But
so I like this, and I'm actually interested. So if you have opinions on the stall count, I think we should talk about this next week.
Sure.
We're going to have a segment on the stall count. If you have opinions about the length of the stall count, shortening it, lengthening it, you can send them to Dusty.
Love it.
Yeah. Or you can send them to at Cleats Cufflinks, and we'll send them
on to me, probably.
And they'll just go on him. But we'll bring that up in our next episode, because I think it's an interesting discussion. I'd be really interested to see what the game would look like with that sort of compressed feature. But getting back to this idea of total football and this idea of positions, we wanted to talk a little bit about, we have cutters and we have throwers, right? That's how we kind of think of the game, right? You know, handlers, cutters, right? But within that handler kind of role, or what we think of, and within that cutter role, there's a different way to kind of think about people's role in the game. And you had pointed this out to me this week, and why don't you lay out kind of what we're talking about?
This in part came out of a discussion that was being held on UltiWorld somewhere at some point, talking about the difference between what a handler does and what a distributor does. So using that as a starting point, we're going to use the three terms of handler, distributor, and thrower.
Okay.
So the idea of a
handler... So in my mind, just so you know, those are all the same person.
Right. And that's exactly why we need to unpack it a little bit and dive into what those words mean.
Let's unpack.
So like a handler is generally someone who runs your offense. Like there's a thing that they're supposed to do when the stall count gets to point X. They're supposed to make like a reset cut, or they're supposed to cut up line or clear for the other handler. Like there's a specific script for the handler in most offenses. So they're in charge of getting that reset, moving the disc to the other side of the field, not moving the disc to the other side of the field, making sure your offense has a fundamental structure. A person that I would use to sort of exemplify that would be Tyler Cable's performance last year for the Stags.
Yeah.
He threw 30 passes frequently in games, was only under 90% completion for two games over the course of the season, only threw three assists in two of those games, maybe three. So his assists aren't high, but his completion rate is really high. And if you watch the video, he's often the lone player back behind or near one of Portland's throwers, whoever has the disc at the time, and he's able to get open in very small spaces and generally quickly moves the disc to the next place where the offense wants the disc. So it's not about his choice. It's about him manifesting what the offense is supposed to be.
I like it. It's kind of a reset, but it's more than just that. Like, the idea is it's not so much that he's just bailing out the thrower.
That's part of it.
It's part of it, yeah. But he's doing it in such a way that it fits with the way that the offense is working.
Specifically within your offense's structure most of the time.
Yeah.
So the next one that we want to think about is a distributor. So what a distributor tends to do is take the disc, survey the field, and decide where the most dangerous place for the disc to go is. It doesn't necessarily have to be a hard throw, and it doesn't necessarily have to be inside or outside of the offense. That individual is generally using their best judgment and their skills in terms of getting the disc to different points on the field quickly and on time, in order to break down the defense, in order to put his teammates or her teammates in a position to succeed with the next throw. So that's often the sort of player that you see delivering a 15-yard or 20-yard break throw at stall four, because at that point, the defense opened up a little bit, gave a little bit of space on the break side, or somebody slacked off a little bit on their mark, and the ability to just distribute it to the right person.
And they're kind of granted a little bit more time in the offense to look downfield.
So that's,
whereas maybe your handler might have a very intentional thing he's meant to do once he catches that reset pass.
And these roles aren't, it's not black and white.
Right, of course not.
You're not one or the other. But so you're accepting pressure from the defense. You're saying, okay, defense, you see where I am. I want to see what you're going to do. And then you read the defense and go from there. This is what quarterbacks tend to do.
Yep.
Like their whole job is to break down the defense and deliver the ball to the right spot. This is what point guards tend to do if they're not scoring point guard. They try to break down the defense a little bit and then get it to the right person from there.
Yeah.
A good example of that from this last year, again going with another Stag,
why not?
Is Dan Supnik. You would often see him holding the disc, surveying the field, sort of looking around, moving his hand up this way, and then getting off a sneaky no-step backhand.
I love the no-step backhand.
Or delivering like an in-cut to somebody who wasn't open until stall five. It's because he's reading the field and saying, okay, this is what needs to happen, and I'm going to make that happen. So you're accepting the pressure for the defense, saying, you can't stop me anyway. Give it your best shot. I'm going to break you down. So the third one that we want to look at, and this is a little shorter Number three is thrower. And thrower is basically someone who, whether through hucks or through break throws or through some skill that they've developed on their own, they're looking at the field and they're saying, I'm going to do this. I'm going to attack the field with my throw. It's not about what the defense is doing. It's about what I can do.
Yeah, it's not waiting for an opportunity. It's creating an opportunity.
So this is the sort of player that you'll see throw someone open who didn't realize that they were open. This is the sort of player that you'll see turn upfield and immediately unleash a 70-yard huck. So they're the sort of player who's always looking to attack and has this skill set to make that happen. Generally, these players have long throws that get there quickly to totally remove the defense from the equation.
Yep.
And a person that I would use as an example from that, again from last year, was Danny Tridiak from the Rainmakers. Some of the throws that he unleashed last year were rockets. They were just...
His hammer.
And it was just right away.
Yeah.
That's just the thing. That he's not necessarily a handler. He's not necessarily a cutter. A thrower can be from any position on the field. A thrower can be anyone. All you have to do is have the skill to deliver the disc downfield.
And when the disc is in that guy's hands, you're open.
Right. You're always open somewhere on the field. Yeah. This is also the play. Like, there are a handful of players in Ultimate that you'll hear their opponents, as soon as they catch the disc, they're just yelling, thrower, 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 thrower. So everybody on the defensive side knows that right now you're not safe.
Yeah.
Wherever you think that you're covering, you need to cover the other places too, because the disc could already be on the way.
I like that. Tridiak is such a good example of that. It's an interesting way to think about the divisions. And as you said, this is not a stark line between different players. Players will these roles are slippery.
For example, I wouldn't say that Supnik is not a thrower. I wouldn't say that Cable is not a thrower.
Right.
And I wouldn't say that they are not distributors, but you fill the role of handler in your offense. You distribute the disc when you have the opportunity. And when you're a thrower, you can distribute the disc anyway.
And in the total ultimate sort of sense of this, those positions could adjust and change over time. Your handler could end up downfield, catching something up line, and then they're in more of that thrower role. They're ready to unleash something.
And part of this relates to the Cruyff thing originally. If you're a thrower, if you're a distributor, you're playing with a bit of ego. You're saying that I have the power to change this. I have the power to make my team do better right now. So you have this idealistic notion of everybody having all of the skills, and then you also have the ego to like exert your will on the game. But at other times, you need to be egoless, and you need to let your teammates exert their will on the game. You need to just distribute. You need to just handle.
Which it's not necessarily being egoless. It's understanding you have a belief in your teammates, and you know,
team ego versus individual.
Yeah, ego. which Cruyff certainly had. And was sometimes disappointed, but he had a belief that everyone who's a phenomenal player should have this phenomenal skill set that allows them to do these phenomenal things.
And if they're not there yet, they should essentially just keep working at it like he did.
Until they
get there. Tirelessly, all the time. Yeah. Not everybody has the same goals. So it's this thing where one of the quotes that I wanted to use from Cruyff was that he said, "Quality without results is pointless. Results without quality is boring." So he's essentially saying...
Is he making fun of Jose Mourinho with
that? Well, always. Because you're just looking for titles with that guy.
Yeah.
But the notion there is that it's not enough to have one or the other.
Yeah.
You want both. And if you're not aiming for both, you're failing.
Yeah, I think that's... If we're going to, you know, admire teams, you know, you have... I think Boston has embodied that kind of result and quality thing over the last few years. They're winning the championships, but they're also really fun to watch on the field.
For sure.
And I think like a lot of teams are striving for that. You know, we have teams that play, I think, what you might call more boring versions of the game. I'm interested to see. I think the spinners were often positioned that way. You know, they a lot of resets, a lot of touches.
It's a certain level of cynicism without having the totally negative connotation of that. It's like, let's do what works.
Yeah. Yeah, and I wonder how that's going to change with the new coaching staff. Yeah,
only one way to find out. About 2 weeks.
About 2 weeks from now, they play two games that first weekend. We'll find out for sure.
Those.
Yeah, it's going to be good. It's going to be
it's
good.
Like unveil. It's like the curtains are opening up. The orchestra is ready to play. We need an overture.
Where are you going to be? You're going to be. Are you going to both?
I'm going to two games the first weekend.
I think you're New York. Exactly I think you're probably calling the Philly game in New York, and then the one back in Philly. Yeah, I'll be down in D.C. on the 9th.
Get me out of D.C.
And then I'll be back to Philadelphia on the 10th.
One of the things I'm looking forward to this season is being with more teams on their back-to-back weekends and seeing them play on Saturday and then Sunday. Because experiencing that with the team a little bit and seeing them go through their ups and downs over the course of that two-day challenge is... That's it gives you insight into how they prepare. And
it's so difficult to win those games. We've seen from statistically, it's very, very difficult to win those two games on the road. I'm going to be really interested to see if some team figures out how to break the code. I think you got to play deep. You know, you got to use your whole lineup. You got to warm up properly. Well. You know, there's a lot of factors in there, but it'll be interesting to see how that works out. All right. Well, that's about all the time that we have for today. Again, our fond memories of Mr. Johan Cruyff, and also hopefully seeing some of his influence bleed into our game, and we're getting excited for the season. So get out there, get tickets, get out to some games, come say hi to me. I'll be there to a lot of them. Don't say hi to Dusty; he'll be busy.
It's very stressful.
And if you have any questions for us on Cleats and Cufflinks, you can of course find me at Nick Darling, and I see Darling.
Or you can reach me at DustWeeter.
Or you can get us both at Cleats Cufflinks. We are excited to be headed into this season, and we'll be back again next week with more Cleats and Cufflinks.